Hey, and welcome to this episode of Real Geeks, straight out of isolation again. Because we're amongst
we'll
the...
We'll be here forever!
Wait, some people are going about the social distancing thing? Yeah.
Yeah.
So...
become a fantastic time capsule in the future. Hey, remember that time we all got fucking stuck inside for months? Wasn't that... fucking kind of cool, but also kind of lame, but also terrifying.
Oh, it was cool for like 3 days. Now it's now shack wacky is setting in.
And it's going to be so difficult to make movies about this. Like, obviously, there's going to be a ton of great thrillers and psychological dramas and comedies, but how the hell do you make an action film or like a gritty political drama about this? All the politics
are going to be political drama and conspiracy theories. That's not a problem. They'll just have this.
Oh, God.
People are seeing now.
But like the sad thing is, we already have Contagion. This movie has already been done.
I'm sorry. No, the greatest pandemic film on Earth is Outbreak. This is unquestionable. It involves a monkey. The monkey gets a starring role next to Dennis Hoffman. That's the single greatest pandemic film in history. Shut the fuck up.
Oh, you're not wrong. Like, we have Outbreak, which is basically the monkey from Friends nearly killing the human race.
Yeah, yeah. It's not a friendly monkey that helps solve the problem like in Outbreak. Outbreak has a friendly fucking monkey. Friendly monkey.
But Contagion is literally coronavirus the movie. As I understand it, it's literally what we're going through right now in every way.
I'll have to watch that when y'all get some tricks.
Yeah.
But that's of course not the movie we're here to discuss, because we're desperately trying not to bring people down.
Well, if we're not trying to bring people down, why the hell do we watch this?
Yeah, so it was literally, I said that, I was like, wait. Instead, we're going back to 2003 to discuss the movie that Mickey has been basically begging to do from the moment she joined the show. The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome, America.
For the record, I have now seen the movie 3 times. Once a few years ago, and then I watched it twice yesterday, and I had to watch it twice because I was confused as fuck throughout the whole first time I watched it yesterday. I'm like, wait a minute, what just, huh? Wait, what? I must have missed something. So yeah, I had to watch it a second time.
I have to know, and like, I have to know right off the top. What was the thing that you missed? What was, I have to know.
Half the movie. It's literally, they're trying to cram so much into it that if you look away from the screen for 2 seconds, you're lost. And then on top of that, there's the camera that is fixed and a distance away from the action, and you see everything. And then there's the camera that's trying to get right up with everybody. And what my hands are doing, this whole blur action thing, is what was going on my TV. So I don't know if it's like the quality. I don't know what it was, but I had to watch it twice.
Fantastic.
Speaking of confusion, Mickey, since this is basically your baby, you want to explain the plot?
Oh, do I ever. All right, so this is very roughly based on the plot of Volume 1 of Alan Moore's League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which came out in 2000. I've been a reader of League since, with near the end of the first volume. It actually just concluded last year. And to give you an idea of where that series ended up relative to this movie, at the end of that comic book run, spoilers for comics, James Bond causes the apocalypse, and Mina Harker, Mina Murray, character from this movie, which we will meet soon, flies off into space to live forever with her constantly transgender, unstable, immortal, Mina's immortal at this point as well, lover with the Martians, specifically John Carter of Mars and his group of Martians. So that's where the comic book ended up, in case you were wondering, hey, where's this movie coming from?
What acid did Alan Moore draw to write this?
Wait, did it freeze on you?
Yeah.
For a split second, yeah.
Okay, all right. Say what you're going to say again.
What acid did Alan Moore drop to write this?
Oh, no, no, you misunderstand. Alan Moore sold acid. That's how he got kicked out of high school in the 70s. He didn't take the acid. Well, he took the acid, but he sold the acid. Anyway.
Yeah. So the actual movie plot.
Yeah. So this plot kicks off in 1899.
Yeah.
Pardon?
Yeah.
Sorry, sounds just a little weird. It begins with, and I can recall this movie. I've seen it so many times out of like hate and desperation that I can recall it almost perfectly. It begins with a World War I M1 tank, British, rolling through a bunch of buildings and the streets, and it rolls over a bobby and crushes him, even though the clearance under an M1 issue tank is actually high enough that if you just lay under it, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
I bring that up because in the commentary for the movie, they make a point that people got fucking pissed about that. And so they were like, no, 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 you can clear it, but we wanted to kill him. But we couldn't show his head being crushed, so we crushed his helmet. Which makes no sense, really. Huh. Anyway, it breaks into the Bank of England, which for some reason in 1899 is being protected by a bunch of khaki-wearing British soldiers. And they bust in, they fire off the cannon, and out comes a bunch of German soldiers. And this crazy-looking guy who's kind of like Genghis Khan meets the Phantom of the Opera, and he steals Leonardo da Vinci's original drawings of Venice for some fucking reason. And then we switch through newspaper spinny about tensions to Germany and the Graf Zeppelin facility, which actually hadn't been built yet for another 9 years. And the same person, but this time accompanied with British soldiers, but they're the same soldiers.
Yeah.
Blow up all the Zeppelins, so it's this race to stop the First World War from starting. Even though it's this one guy, this one really recognizable supervillain doing it. And not the British or the Germans. All they had to do was talk and be like, is he your guy? He's not our guy. Why the fuck will you blow up our stuff? Huh. We then transition to Africa.
I've all played this. Yes.
Yes.
Well, Africa, that one kind of works, but...
We transition to Africa, where a British colonial... hotel slash bar and a man from MI6 whose name is not mentioned in the movie, but it is Champion Bond. He is the great grandfather of James Bond. You can tell because of his clothing and his specific facial hair.
Yeah.
In the comic book, he's about 300 pounds. he's looking for Alan Quatermain, the famous adventure hero from the King Solomon's Mines and She Who Must Be Obeyed. He's talking to some old guy, and the old guy's like, hey, yes, yes, I'll tell you some stories. And then Sean Connery, like, whips his head around and says something sort of smart-assy, but because this is a badly written movie, it's just kind of like, okay, there's Sean Connery. And then guys come in with machine guns and shoot the fucking place up. Anyway, they have to set up a league of Victorian-based literary superheroes to find out why and who and what is trying to set off a world war and to stop the world war. And then, spoiler alert, by the end of it, we find out it was James Moriarty with the bat suit.
Oh, and the sad thing is, it's actually not by the end of it when you find out. It's by the end of the sequence where they're recruiting Dorian Gray.
Yes.
Because his second in command, and I can totally understand how people would have missed this. Because, like, when I first saw this when it was in the theaters, I had totally missed this part. And this is the only reason the reveal later worked at the time. But his second in command, the guy who's running this attack, shouts, "Run, James!"
Yeah, run, James. It's like, oh yeah, no, that's not the most obvious thing on earth. Now, here's the thing. It is the most obvious thing to fans of the comic book, because James Moriarty was the villain at the end of Volume 1.
Yeah.
But he didn't, like, pretend to be a supervillain called the Phantom, who is actually not based on the Phantom of the Opera, but a concept at the time for a supervillain in early cinema called Fantuma.
But they reference the Phantom of the Opera anyway.
Even though it's clearly, like, yeah, he makes one operatic reference, but his image, his everything is not the Phantom at all. It's fantastic. I really love the design of him until he reveals that it's just Richard Roxburgh. Ta-da!
And, I mean, as much as we're obviously going to go into detail here, I think we can all immediately agree this movie is stupid.
Oh, it's delightfully stupid. It's a Stephen Sommers film. Of course it's stupid.
And I mean, but like, take Geostorm, for instance, where one of my favorite scenes in the movie is the beach in Brazil, where a bikini-clad beachgoer outruns a falling plane. They break physics.
Yep.
This movie breaks physics to a similar degree in less than 5 minutes of screen time.
Isn't it glorious?
Because
I love hate this film. It's one of the films that I always made sure I had a DVD copy of. It's fucking bizarre. I saw this in theaters. I was excited to see this in theaters.
Like, the opening scene that you mentioned with the tank rolling into the Bank of London. Now, when he rolls over the cop in defiance of any degree of common sense on the part of the cop, because obviously if the tank is not going to stop the first time you yelled stop, he's not going to stop the 12th.
Yeah, don't literally do the gag from Austin Powers with the guy standing in front of the steamroller yelling stop. It's one thing to make that joke. Funny joke, fine. If you seriously attempt it as a serious scene, it's horrible. You almost have you have to over the top and have a lot of gore to, like, offset the fact that it's like, yeah, okay, yeah. No, just step to your left, man. Or the right.
Yeah,
You could crawl over the thing.
Like, but
it's a Mark I tank. It's just gonna go.
But the tank gets into the bank, parks about this far from the vault door.
Fires four shots in, I believe, like half a second. Even if it's just the same shot. So, like, here's the thing. Is it so fucking stupid that it's four shells in half a second? Or did they repeat the same shot four times for effect? And therefore, they repeated the same shot four times for effect.
You know what? the sad thing is, it's probably both. But it was like, okay, number one, the front of that tank should be completely destroyed. And number two, all the soldiers in the side of the tank at this point should basically be jelly.
Pretty much. Oh yeah, God, from the reverb of that, yeah. But anyway, yeah, they fire a shell point blank at the door, And then they walk in and they get parchments. If the thing that you're looking for to break out of a safe or a vault is parchment paper, don't fire a fucking shell at it.
Well, you know, he's kind of protected the paper, which I guess they're hoping we all believe.
And what it really, it finally hit me, like, watching this time, and I should say, I actually enjoyed the film this time more than I've ever enjoyed it. he's getting the original sketches of, Venice, of the under what's-its of Venice, the undercarriage. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure you could have just, like, bought a book of those.
No, I don't understand why he needed the originals when they actually bring in later on, well, these aren't the originals, they're only copies.
Yeah. It's like...
Okay, so the copies were sufficient for the League. Why weren't they sufficient for Phantom?
Right? Their authenticity should only matter if he was like, aha, I have Leonardo's greatest secrets and I will ransom them because I stole your important shit. Oh. Come on, give me money. But it's a literal use. But it's also like, okay, it's a literal use. You're trying to get an idea of where to plant the bombs to best fuck with Venice. But those were drawn 400 years before.
Yeah. That's the issue, the heist itself, as badly executed as it is, and make no mistake, I had no problem with that itself because it works in terms of stirring up tensions between the two political powers.
Oh, I love the concept.
Yeah.
As a comic book, maybe not as a comic book movie, but as a comic book concept, I can see how it would have gone. That doesn't happen in the comics itself. I'm so forgiving of this film now, 17 years after its release, and it's funny because it's because we got the incredible high quality of films like the Dark Knight trilogy and the Marvel Cinematic Universe that I can look at this more fondly as almost like the best place that this film could ever be played is in the lobby, like on the walls above the concession and whatnot, before, during intermission, and after showings, like a movie marathon of the MCU. Because it's essentially the Avengers boiled down and just used in a different concept. Like, and it wasn't even intended at the time to be the Avengers, because the Avengers in 2003... let alone in 2000 when the book was written, were fucking no ones. No one wanted to touch the Avengers. But it's the perfect on-screen Avengers group. They have their murderous assassin lady with the red and black motif.
Yeah.
They've got their Hulk. They've got their Tony Stark, even though, you know, this Tony Stark does a lot of combat, like physical combat. We'll get into that later because that's really fucked up.
Oh, yeah.
Everything about.
But with the heist of his plan, like the stealing of the plans themselves, just the fact that you met, like you said, they're hundreds of years old, they're ancient. Shit has changed. Shit has changed, except for one thing, which should immediately tell you what the villain's plot is.
Huh. Waterways?
Like, the only thing that's not different would be the supports under the city of Venice. What could he be planning to do?
I wonder.
And that's where I had the issue with it, because it's like, telegraphed much?
Oh yeah, no, it's not a sly mystery, that's for sure.
Oh, no.
Like, they are incredibly stupid characters. And these are characters who are supposed to be really on the ball. In the comics, the leader of the group isn't Quartermain. Quartermain is an addict. He's a morphine addict. The leader is Mina, and she's reserved and brilliant. here she's a vampire and gets random lines when they feel like giving it to her. And so you're left with a plot that's essentially just reacting to stuff instead of, like, Mina in the books is a very proactive character. This is the lady who defeated fucking Dracula. She's not an idiot.
No, and...
They very much portrayed that, though, in the movie. It was, like, literally the helpless damsel female character that... And that was one of the biggest issues I had with it. Never mind her hair. I had issues with how they treated the sole woman in the whole group.
And that, not only the sole woman, the main fucking character of this entire line. There is not a story, with a couple of exceptions that follow Nemo's daughter, but that's the fact of, like, these comics are very female-centric, because, like, the one time they skew off Mina, it's to Nemo's daughter of all people. But there's not one story in this entire line of comics that isn't about Mina, and to do her so fucking dirty in this film.
Yeah, like, the frustrating thing is, like, I honestly, Peter Wilson, who played Mina, was one of the people in this movie that I honestly felt sorry for, because from an acting perspective, that character could have been very believable as the leader.
Yeah.
With one exception. The sequence where they're trying to save Venice and Quartermain, Mina, and Tom Sawyer, who, just editing note, if we could have the opening 5 seconds of Tom Sawyer by Rush every time Tom Sawyer gets mentioned in this review.
You got it.
So, like I said, Quartermain, Sawyer and Mina are driving through the Venice streets in the physically impossible to actually drive car.
Yeah.
And they're firing away at the random soldiers conveniently already placed on the various rooftops. And Mina has the line, "Save your bullets, these men are mine," where she suddenly goes Wicked Witch of the West. For no discernible reason and in complete defiance of everything we've seen from the character up to that point.
Oh yeah, no, like, it's like a flip of a switch. She just suddenly becomes, you know, evil vampire lady who is completely bloodthirsty, but, like, that just turns off and she's like, "Oh, heavens, I'm Victoria."
Well, I mean, to be fair, she is, well, okay, Peter Wilson's Australian, but Mina Harker is English, is she not?
Yes, she is, yeah.
So maybe that refined English upbringing can just totally negate the whole vampire lust inside of her.
No.
I'm trying.
I mean, I could almost buy that, the way that they downplay their discovery that she is a vampire during the meetup with Dorian Gray, but... if this were a better movie... that would have worked.
Yeah, and, like, it's really frustrating because there's a lot of things about this that could have worked.
Yeah.
The first time we meet the Invisible Man, and in all of the promotional material for it, they had this awesome CGI effect where he had grease paint over his face and the trench coat. But that's it. The rest of it was invisible.
Yeah.
And that's what the character looked a lot like in the comics. It's a really cool fact, and I guess it was just a little too expensive to do at the time.
Yeah.
Instead, they just slather white grease paint over the actor completely and go, fuck. It looks horrible. It's like, do you remember the movie Powder?
I haven't seen it, but I do know of it. And yeah, I can see where you're coming from.
Yeah, so Powder was this movie in the mid to early 90s about an albino man who had, like, electricity powers. Yeah.
Yeah, I have seen that eons ago.
Yeah, but instead of the Invisible Man, who you could have just not, you know, you could have had an actor off screen saying his lines, and that would work just fine. Instead, they have this guy who looks like Powder. So it's like the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and Powder. Zap.
Yeah, I think there was that scene where the Invisible Man has snuck into Quatermain's quarters for really no discernible reason. And Quatermain just grabs him, throws him out, and he has that line, "You're to be wearing clothes at all times." That scene, I think that was probably, like, I could see where that would be just for the budget.
Yeah, well, exactly. It's just for the budget. It's leaning into the comics in which the Invisible Man does betray the group to the Martians when they invade. So it's kind of like, you do expect this character to be the traitor, but you've already met Dorian Gray. You know that he's the guy who's going to betray them, and this is a really obvious red herring. It's so bad and pointless.
It's one of those, I think it works, would have worked for the general movie-going audience at the time.
Yeah.
But film itself has evolved to such a point since then that you're watching, you recognize the story structure, and it's like, yeah, this is kind of obvious. One of the most frustrating things with this movie overall is that I think if this movie were done today instead of 2003, it would have worked.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Rewatching it, I had the sudden feeling that if this could land on not necessarily HBO, but maybe Netflix or something, if they could do League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, it could be amazing. Like, really drawn out, really layered stuff. It could be an actually beautiful show instead of this proto-Avengers mess. God, I want to rant about so many things. and I'm it's almost like it's out of etiquette that I don't just keep talking.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, like I said, this movie itself could have worked. They could do a sequel and it would work. Because, you know, like I've mentioned to you, Mickey, in the past about how you could easily take the Rocketeer, the Phantom, the Shadow, and build a shared universe there.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at this movie when I was watching yesterday, it's like, that's a sequel roster right there. And
Oh no, excuse me. There is already a built-in sequel and hints towards a sequel and a larger universe that already exist in this that were intentionally placed because they thought they were going to get it.
Yeah.
There is a newspaper on a wall when they are walking towards the wharf for the first time to meet the Nautilus. And it talks about the explosions on Mars.
Yeah.
They are setting up the Martian invasion for the sequel, which would have then included everything from Dr. Moreau to Winnie the Pooh.
Okay, I want this movie just because I desperately want to know how you bring Winnie the Pooh into the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I want to see some film writer try and do it.
I can tell you. Dr. Moreau didn't stop at just engineering animal humans, which Winnie the Pooh is one of. He eventually got into germ warfare, and he created a super bacteria that they then fire at the Martians and then cover up, because it's a war crime, as just being, oh, they got the common cold and died.
See, again, right here, this is already a better movie, and like I said, The Rocketeer.
I'm just going to keep going because this is how much better a movie it would have been. To which Nemo storms off and dedicates three generations of his family to terrorism against the British because they have turned to such horrible weapons that he knows will then be used against his people. It is a fucking. It would be like a film of like, oh, holy shit, we can't say that. The Nemo from this movie spin kicking and being generally like two-dimensional, he suddenly is just like, I hate you for what you did to save all these people. I'm now going to do nothing but kill your people until I die. And then my child's going to do it. And then my grandchild's going to do it. Fuck you. Oh, yeah. And by the end of the comic, the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen themselves have become a terrorist cell. And those are the heroes. There is no like, oh, they become the bad guys. No, they become terrorists because the oppressive system in the UK is so evil and fascist, it has to be fought on more aggressive means.
So I have to ask, at the end of the movie, they hint that, you know, Africa, as per its curse, whatever you want to call it, will not let Quartermain die. Did the comics bring him back? Like, did that part happen in the comics, or...?
It's more complicated than that. So Quartermain in the comics is an opium addict, and he's kind of hopeless. He does at one point get killed, and they find a mystical pool, the mystical pool of Dido, I believe, in Africa, that turns them Mina. It turns her immortal. It revives and youthifies Alan Quartermain. And the third character, Orlando, who was originally written by Virginia Woolf and is an amalgamation of her gender-switching character, Orlando, and the mythical character of Roland. I know way too much about this. As well as the character Ego from Greek myth.
Sure.
Character. They all become immortal because of this pool. Same pool that James Bond later detonates a nuclear weapon over because he hates women so much. That's the actual reason. Anyway, Alan Quartermain does get brought back. Like they say the whole Africa won't let him die. He's brought back, and there's a whole running storyline fighting She, who is a character from Alan Quartermain's books, who is a... Imagine an African white society ruled, like, the political system is dominatrix. She's the dominatrix of this white jungle, semi-futurist, but tribal society. This was written in the 1890s. anyway, Alan Quartermain eventually gets murdered by Harry Potter. The end.
What?!
Alan Quartermain gets murdered by Harry Potter, who was actually created by Aleister Crowley to be the child of the apocalypse, until Mary Poppins turns him into paint and he washes away.
It worries me that this is kind of workable.
So aside from the majority of what you just said, I want to ask one question in reference to it. Yeah. Mina is a vampire.
Yep.
No.
In the movie.
In the movie, Mina's a vampire. Okay. Yeah. So in the comics, she's not, but she is immortal because of the pool of Dido.
Yeah. Unrelated.
So why did the movie make her a vampire?
Because a school teacher with PTSD isn't interesting for a film like this.
And I've got to figure they wanted to bring in the Dracula story somehow.
Yeah, and it's always hanging around with her character. They never really talk about it. She's always just like, I don't want to talk about it, but I've been through more shit than you have. Also, in the comics, instead of just being the two puncture wounds, it's like her entire throat is scarred from, like, gnawing and ripping and stuff. Yeah. Like, Dracula isn't... Her Dracula in the comics isn't a romantic Dracula. It's the fucking horror Dracula.
So, why did he have a snack or even a main meal out of her but not turn her?
Because this... book is not, or because the book was written by a man who didn't think things through and was looking for money, The movie was written by a man who didn't think things through and was looking,
was
for, money.
Looking for money.
And directed by a man who had no idea what he was doing.
Yes. And Alan Moore wanted to use the character so much that he killed her husband off off screen. And you actually never find out what happened to Mr. Harker.
Jonathan.
Fuck, yeah. There's Jonathan, thank you. All I can see is Keanu Reeves. And I didn't want to say Keanu Reeves.
No, that's fair.
And... I'm British. I'm...
Yeah, and like, but like, in all seriousness, though, I feel so sorry for everyone who had to be in front of the camera in this movie, because
I didn't say that's much, though. I mean, Peter Wilson playing Nina Harker actually is a step up from La Femme Nikita.
Yeah,
and I mean, I love Nikita. I loved watching La Femme Nikita, but I also know that they didn't do as good a job on that as they could have, and they certainly didn't use her to her abilities. Because, well, it was 80s, 90s TV shows, and it was Canadian done. So, you know.
Good old-fashioned syndication. But, yeah. Like,
I was it actually had to play non-syndication, so.
There are some fantastic actors in this who try their best and don't get their due. Nemo's performed by apparently a very, very well-known Indian performer. I can't think of his name right now, but he's fantastic. For what he needs to be, the guy performing the Invisible Man, he pulls it off.
Yeah.
He's kind of...
Tony Curran. Tony Curran, who Doctor Who fans would know as Vincent Van Gogh.
Yes.
He's beautifully, just charmingly annoying.
Yes. Yeah, instead of like... Yeah. He could have been very annoying, but he was charmingly annoying.
Yeah.
Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde actually somewhat have separate personalities, so at least they bothered to do that. That's performed really well. Jesus Christ, who the fuck else is in this? Oh, yeah. Tom, what's his name?
Tom Sawyer.
Yeah, Tom Sawyer was Shane West, who... As I understand it, he's just there for American audiences to have a character to connect with.
Correct. And so they split Sean Connery's version of Alan Quartermain in two. And Sean Connery hated that kid so much. They fought on set constantly. And this film was so miserable for Connery, he quit acting afterwards. This film...
I can see why. And because you had mentioned that before, and I'm in the back of my mind remembering that he stopped acting, and I'm like, I watching this train rail, like this accident happen, I can understand why. It's
now,
so bad.
Right, do you want to know why he took this role?
Yes.
Oh, I gotta hear this.
It's magical. Yeah, this is magical. So... way back in 1999 or 98, he was offered a role that he thought sounded fucking stupid as all shit. He didn't understand it. He said he literally didn't understand it. What the hell is going on in this? I hate it. I'm not doing it. And he was the first choice of the director. That role was Gandalf.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah,
so,
Connery was supposed to be Gandalf.
Pissed. Yeah, super fucking pissed that he didn't get to be Gandalf by his own mistake. He said, I'm never gonna opt out of one of these silly films again. The next silly film I get, even if I don't understand it, especially if I don't understand it, if I don't understand the script, I'm gonna take it. And he got offered Alan Quartermain, and he looked at the script and went, this is fucking ridiculous. It's probably gonna make $1 billion.
Well... Yeah, Connery passed on Gandalf. I think at one point he was offered Morpheus or, like, something in the Matrix.
I believe he was an early Morpheus choice.
Yeah. So, yeah, he was offered a lot of major, like, iconic roles that he passed on. And then, oh, man.
Whoops.
When you think about it, it's kind of amazing that he even took the role of role in Highlander. I mean, how the hell did that make enough sense? You're gonna be a Spanish guy and you die, but you came back and you're immortal. But if someone cuts your head off and someone's gonna cut your head off, you'll die and it'll inspire the main character. You're not the main character. It'll inspire the main character. It's like, what the fuck?
Oh, God. And to instead have to say things like, we've identified him as the Phantom. How operatic. Shut up!
We've identified him as the Phantom. That doesn't mean anything to me. I'm not the audience.
Yeah.
You can scream Khan all the fuck you want. It doesn't mean anything.
When did Gaston LaRue put out Phantom of the Opera?
1880? Where the hell's my copy of that? I don't know where my copy is.
Yeah,
I don't know the exact year, but I know that the character would have been the right time period.
Okay.
But
oh yes, no, like,
it's
that's fine.
It's like I've talked about often in the past about references in movies and how they have to contribute in some way versus making a reference for the sake of making a reference. Which, man, this movie insists on doing it. I hate that.
This is the reference, by the way. This is Phantom Op. This is the poster that ran in 1902 in French cinemas. Phantom Op was a terrorist character.
Yeah, I would never have gotten that from this movie.
Oh, I know. It's such a deep cut.
And while we're still on the Phantoms, one thing that I did notice with the character design that was driving me up the wall is his mask. He's permanently winking! And I don't know why!
I know, it doesn't make any sense. Like, he's covering... You can see his shitty side of his face, but he's completely covering up the good side of his face? It really doesn't make sense, but I love the design! It's so stupid! So stupid!
And
why the fuck? Why? Why? You could wear a normal mask and just call yourself the Phantom. Why do you need the makeup effects?
Yeah.
1909. Ooh, Gaston LaRue's book was published in 1909.
Really?
Ooh. So he stole from the movie. That's awesome. The movie, like, has nothing to do with an opera. I think he bombs an opera. But the more, like, in-character thing would be, like, for instance, putting a mechanism in a jewelry store, and at peak hours, it springs up and sprays razor blades at everyone. This is what people at the time came up with.
And... I mean, for the time period, you could go, yeah, all right. And more or less on a kind of similar note, I think with a movie like this, there's two ways you can go. You can go either dead serious action film or full-blown steampunk ridiculousness. This seems to try to do both.
Yeah, and does really neither.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you can't do that.
Like, the Nautilus is gorgeous. It is. It's not as cool as the one in the comics that is in the shape of a Kraken. But it's a really pretty sea sword, I guess.
Well, yeah.
But it doesn't have anything. The Sword of the Seas.
Yeah.
At one point in time, they referred to it as the Sword of the Sea.
Yeah, and while we're still at Nemo and the Nautilus, that was one of my biggest character problems. Well, first of all, the actor was Nasreddin Shah, and the issues that I had are not with him.
No, he had no character, and he did what he could. He at least looked very much like Nemo. I'm happy that they didn't whitewash Nemo.
Yeah. And
Nemo.
They set up the idea of a pacifist character in violent situations, which, like, okay, like, there's a lot you can do there. The movie doesn't do most of it, but, yeah. And they set up early on that he doesn't like guns. He has no problem building guns for his crew whatsoever.
And here's the funny thing. It's a complete 180 to the character in the comic. And there's even a line in the movie that is just like, what the fuck? When they pull the guns on him and he says, I walk a different path, and then does kung fu for some reason, that's not Nemo. Nemo, very specifically, is Tony Stark if he hated white people. There's a moment in the comics when he's being charged at by a mob with knives, and he takes out this goddamn ridiculous gun that is half the size of him. He's holding it with one arm. It's in the shape of a fish, and it fires a harpoon through the entire group. This is a man who made a harpoon machine gun in the shape of a fish later on in that very volume. He loves guns. He builds technology. It's usually in the shape of a fish, and he can fire it at white people. That's the character. Shoot guns at white people.
Have y'all seen, heard the song Wet Dream by Kip Adodo?
No.
You have to. Because you're referencing, like, everything's in the shape of a fish. It's from Dr. Demento, and it's a parody, and everything in it is a fish reference. Mike, you'll love it.
Now,
Kip Adodo, Wet Dream. Just trust me, you'll thank me.
for my part, like that character change with Nemo, I have no problem with. Like, the movie seems to want him to be a seafaring Batman, which...
Yes, yeah, he's good at everything, but we don't want to lean on him, even though we could just make this a Nemo.
And it's like, you know, like, he has the I walk a different path line. It's like, okay, you've done something to build a character of some sort. Okay, fine. We skip ahead to the final battle in Moriarty's factory, which... Actually, I've listened to enough radio plays and pulp stories that a war factory in the mountains was kind of a nice touch.
Oh, and I love how cliche intentionally it was. It's not like boring cliche. It has to be like a volcano / mountain hideout fortress. Come on, we're roll into this stuff hard. I halfway expected Tintin to like pop around the corner.
But there's a point during that where he picks up a gun and starts firing like it's nothing, going against everything that they've done with the character up to this point.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. You know, I walk another path. Ooh! I do like the sequence where in the factory hideout thing, I kind of... You know, like, okay, yeah, you're going to make yourselves a bunch of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and then start a war and then sell it to them. Okay. You know, it's a weird thing. When I sat in the theaters watching Sherlock Holmes' Game of Shadows and seeing this exact plot get played out, but, like, be taken more seriously, I felt so pissed. But, like, I don't know why.
Yeah.
Because I enjoyed the movie.
Yeah.
I didn't hear you.
Oh, I just said yeah.
Oh, okay.
I had issue with the Nautilus itself.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, number one, you had their tracking system for following the little explorer sub that makes no sense whatsoever. No, tracking system where neither point is actually moving.
Gorgeously practical with the tentacles doing longitude and latitude. Like, he has an entire globe built and set into the wall. This is a submarine. They're incredibly cramped. And he said, fuck you. We're putting an entire globe in the wall so that on this side, for this one particular instance that will probably never happen again, we can pull it out and like the wall will separate and it'll be a tracking system. They built this.
Neither of these needles moves. It's tracking nothing. you get no sense of progress, that you don't know if they're getting closer or further away or whatever.
Well, how the fuck do you get a submarine up the side of a fucking mountain?
Oh, in fact, I'm going to build on that with my second issue with the Nautilus, which was just the sheer scale. Like, this is basically a submarine the size of an aircraft carrier. In the ocean, I can go, okay, fine. I can work with that. But then, they are piloting a submarine the size of an aircraft carrier through the canals of Venice.
Isn't it delightful? Not only through the canals of Venice, but like under Venice. Venice is a swamp. It's not that deep.
Yeah.
And keep in mind, they pulled this fucker up to a wharf as well, off Wapping. The Thames isn't deep enough.
No, and to go from this to one of my all-time favorite films, The Shadow, which was done about 10 years earlier and somehow has better CG in places.
Oh, it is. But that's a delight. The knife, the flying knife, delightful.
But there are sequences there where everyone, like, the characters are driving through the streets in a cab, and if you're watching the backgrounds closely enough, that cab should have driven straight through at least three buildings. And, oh no, one of these days we will do a watch through for this movie and I will point this out.
Delightful.
But I noticed that when they're bringing the Nautilus through the canals of Venice, which, again, just plain no. The moment where you see the sub scraping up against the buildings and the arches over the canal,
we can go no further.
At that point, I realized something. The conning tower of the Nautilus should have already destroyed three or four buildings.
Correct. It should have gone through numerous walkways.
Yeah.
Every bridge, because there's bridges all over Venice. Because believe it or not, people don't take boats everywhere in Venice. The fuckers walk a lot. It was the weirdest thing. And like, the more you think about it, the weirder it gets. Why does blowing up Venice start the First World War?
It's
the whole thing's just dumb upon dumb upon dumb upon dumb.
Well, why blowing up Venice would start the First World War? There's a conference there or something where I'm kind of going, I can see why blowing up this conference would have done it, with the tensions being between countries as built up as they are in the movie. It's like, okay, fine. However,
That's a Zack Snyder mistake. You don't blow up everyone and then everything is okay, or like everything gets thrown into a chaos or whatever. If you blow up everyone, they're going to ask why you blew up everyone. It's a Cobra Commander strategy. You only do it if you're trying to hold the Earth hostage with a weather dominator. You don't blow up everyone or threaten to blow up everyone to start a war between those people. They're gonna fucking kill you instead. Dr. Manhattan's a war criminal.
Well, see, like, I'll give you that, but I will also say that in this scenario, the solution was worse than the problem.
Yes. My God, yes. Let's blow up part of Venice before it can blow up.
So they decide they have to fire a rocket ahead of this chain of exploding Venetian buildings in order to stop the explosion. Like, it's the equivalent of digging a trench to stop a raging forest fire, which by itself, like, that that I could have gone with that. I almost did. But then they did one thing that completely destroyed what passes for logic in this moment.
Damn it.
Now, so Quartermaine and Sawyer and eventually at some point Mina, because why not, are rocketing through the city in the car from hell. And this goes to what I mentioned about Mina earlier. But the idea is that the Nautilus can track the car, and they're going to use the car to target the rocket. Okay, fine. Mina jumps out to combat soldiers. Quartermaine spots Moriarty, so he jumps out. And then Sawyer jumps the car over a canal and smashes into a building on the other side. Now, number one, I'm sorry, but Sawyer is now dead. There's no way he's not, because the car smashes into that building top first, and it's a convertible! And if that didn't kill him, if plowing through the wall doesn't kill him, the building crashing onto him had to. That's problem number one. Problem number two, that canal is positioned to do the exact same thing that that rocket is supposed to do. The plan is completely unnecessary.
Oh, yeah. No, it makes no sense. It's stupid. And that's not even getting into the fact that out of the blue, the solution is let's launch a V2 rocket out at it. And it's like, what do you... And no character questions this. No one goes, what the fuck is that? What the fuck? Rockets didn't exist yet. Cars, oddly enough, did exist. People knew what an automobile was. V2 rockets firing out of submarines? What the fuck?
Well, so I'm still trying to figure out how they managed to track the car, and then he fires the flare to go, okay, so shoot here. And there was no input of longitude. There was no input of coordinates at all. It was just, okay, fire!
Oh, yeah, no, like, the Nautilus, like, Nemo having invented a rocket, I could go...
And then comes way down.
Oh, yeah, like, Nemo, the Nautilus having rockets, I have no problem in and of itself, because the Nautilus itself should not exist in this world to begin with. So, I kind of have to go, okay, fine.
The funny thing is, they could have, like, pulled an actual joke that would have been topical for the time that this was set in. If he just had a big deck gun come out of it, like an enormous fucking gun, and it fired, and it did the same thing, that would have actually been like three-dimensional chess level intelligent, because that's what in 1899 people were worried about when it came to actual global politics. You can build a big fucking gun. It could have been like so smart and went over everyone's heads, and it would have actually been dumber than a rocket, because it would have just been a big fucking gun.
Oh, and even just with rockets in this movie in general, if you go back to the opening sequences, we've already seen a wire-guided rocket fired with far more range than it should possibly have.
Into hydrogen-filled Zeppelins that, one, the Zeppelins hadn't been built at that time yet. They were being designed, but they hadn't been built. Two, Germany wasn't using hydrogen for Zeppelins until the Americans imposed
embargo.
Embargo, thank you very much. Until Americans imposed a trade embargo on Nazi Germany, who these are not.
No. Like I said, there's enough fantastical elements where I could have gone with it, but by the end of that sequence where they have broken even my suspension of disbelief, mine!
Can I get to a point at the end, right now, just jump to it, that I really want to get into that's just, like, emblematic of how dumb this film is?
Oh yeah, go for it.
the character development, the character arc of Tom Sawyer, our American character, is that he learns how to shoot a guy.
Yep.
That's with only one bullet.
Yep.
With only one bullet. He's not doing Yankee shooting. He's only using one bullet.
Yeah. He's using one bullet, and he's shooting a man in the back. And that's his character arc. Congratulations, American. You're now capable of shooting men. You're a hero now. Go.
Oh, yeah. And, like, there's... Again, like, there's so much that could have been done there. Instead, we've had numerous sequences of Tom Sawyer firing guns of random ammo capacity.
Kablam, 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 kablam.
Because he's pulling out a pair of six shooters that, and I swear to God, I was so bored I counted this, fired up to 14 times.
Amazing. Amazing. A seven shooter. Delightful. I love his costume, his attempt at sneaking in with the Phantom's men, of just barely wearing a cape and having the helmet on his head. If I was the other guys, I'd be like, what is this, fucking Casual Friday? Jesus. Are we shooting at us now? Oh.
Like at least a moment, like a half second clip of him, like, pulling off a trench coat or something.
Yes. Oh, speaking of pulling off a trench coat. So you know that moment when the Invisible Man throws booze in his face and then tries to get the coat off, right?
Yeah.
Did you notice that was a weirdly frenetic take? Like, it was weird. Like, really weird. He was just getting his jacket off, but they treat like this super action moment. They had one take to do it. One take. Because of the removal of the makeup in the shot. Because it's an active removal of the makeup. He throws water in his face and then
makeup comes off.
So they had one take to do this, do the timing, and he couldn't get the fucking jacket off.
Which is
why the actual shot, if you think about it, is him struggling to get a jacket off. And that is the Invisible Man's action shot of the entire film. That's the one they put in the trailers. Him trying to take his jacket off.
Can I also point out, you know, they're all meeting up with him later to wherever he's led them, and it's snow covered and it's cold, and they've all got the white parkas and, you know, their gear on, and they're all freezing cold, and he just shows up and points out that he's not wearing anything.
Yeah.
Okay, so, I was hoping that was what you were going to say.
How long did it take you to walk from point A to point B, dude? Because I'm pretty sure frostbite hits pretty quick there. And who brought the coat for him? Who brought the grease paint for him? He doesn't have pockets. He didn't carry it with him.
He has a pocket.
I'm not even touching that one with a 10-foot pole.
You don't want to touch his pocket?
No, like,
oh, not the one I assume you're talking about.
them bringing a coat and the grease paint for him, that I could buy, because like they knew that he was gonna be there. However,
from point A to point B in the frostbite.
Well, like,
that's my however.
This is the worst day of his life too, because after getting frostbite on presumably everything, but especially his dick, because it's just out.
Yeah.
He then gets lit on fire. Like, to the point that his invisibility stops working on sections of his body. At the end of this film, he's like 50% third-degree burns.
And I don't know if this was just a bad cinematography thing or what, but it was like he suddenly got lit on fire for no reason.
Yeah, because we already have an invisible person get lit on fire in this same sequence, and no way to tell the difference between one and the other. But we light our Invisible Man on fire for a reason. Go get it, boy. Go get it. Go get the reason, boy.
like I think it was supposed to be that he got it was supposed to be that he got clipped by the flamethrower when he was trying to save Sawyer, but that was not what it looked like.
Yeah, it's like, okay, I can understand that if those characters had any lead up or relationship to, like, maybe they didn't get along and this is him putting himself in harm's way.
Yeah.
And that means that they're comrades now. Maybe they were really close and he's sacrificing himself. No. In fact, I don't know if they have any direct lines to each other until that moment.
Off the top, like, I don't think they really did. Like, I get the idea was kind of a redemption for the character, which fine, but...
Which makes no sense because he didn't do anything wrong. They thought he was the bad guy. You don't need redemption if everyone else thinks you're an asshole and they're wrong.
Well, I mean, even before that, because he was a thief before the leak. So
yeah.
It's redemption stuff that happened before the leak.
No, his redemption in that instance would be working for the fucking government. That's why he works for the fucking government.
But the thing was, when he goes to tackle the dude with the it looks, honest to God, like the flamethrower's stream shoots out,
Turns
90 degrees, and then hits him.
Yeah, it's like in post, they were like, fuck, this doesn't line up at all. There, now he's on fire. Are you happy? That does lead in, though, to one of the best shots of this film. A frustratingly good shot. Well, maybe not shot, design. So everyone gets their opposite, except for Nemo. It would have been hilarious to see him fight, like, an opposite color-coded Nemo played by the same guy. And it's just like, we made sure he was Indian, too. And it's like, you know, that's actually really super racist that you're like, we have to have a Nemo and he has to be Indian. Or maybe get like a flint-heart Glomgold version of to his Scrooge. And so it's like, it's another guy who's like really Indian, but not the same like design, like Sikh design.
You don't even have to go that far. It could have been he drops them off and then it's good Nautilus versus evil Nautilus in like sequence of like a mini hunt for Red October.
Oh god, you could have Sean Connery making a bunch of Red October that'd be great. That can't be in this movie. It's too fun. anyway, yeah, so everyone pairs off against their opposites. Except for Mina, of course.
Her. She's got to have the conflict with Dorian. Because, you know, backstory and all.
Yeah, because jilted ex-bisexuals have to fight.
Oh, of course.
I actually kind of like that. That's fun. we get Jekyll and Hyde face off against the second in command to the Phantom, who I don't think was ever given a name.
I doubt it.
I'm going to call him Reinhardt.
Okay.
I believe his name's Reinhardt.
Sure.
Yeah. No, I believe his name's Reinhardt. He chugs the entire vial of Hulk serum, and he becomes this enormous red monster thing.
Yeah,
that's what Hyde actually looks like, and it was gorgeous to see.
You know what? It was good for me. in terms of the CG in that scene. I would just like to stop and take a moment to apologize to the entire DCEU because I've been on their cases a lot for bad CG, but the proverbial Red Hulk here, he looked so bad. Like he looked half rendered.
I love crap CG when it is super accurate to the original artistic intent. Like, that it looks bad and wrong makes sense because it's Mr. Hyde. He's supposed to make you feel bad and wrong when you see him. He's supposed to be so weird and grotesque and terrifying looking that you're just like, that's a wrong thing. He's the distillation of everything bad about humanity.
I mean,
I love the idea that it looks like shit. I love the idea it's like Fifth Planet too. I mean,
like on the one hand, you're not wrong, but at the same time, for me, he looked so shiny and just cartoonish that it just looks so completely unfinished.
Here's what it comes down to. Would you rather have that look or the styrofoam arm Biff Tannen?
I mean, yeah, like I'll totally give you that. But like, you have Hyde himself in the same scene, who just visually looks better in every way. Like this Uber Hyde just needed a couple more passes in the CG department.
And that's very fair. That's very true. This was very 2003.
You do have to cut them a little slack because of that. However.
So anyway, Uber Hyde, Renfield, or Reinhold,
who the hell cares?
Gets crushed. Yeah. Who fuck cares? Evil Invisible Man gets lit on fire. Dorian Gray dies when she stabs him and then makes him look at the portrait. She's like, okay, that's kind of cool. I mean, like, that's a cool sequence. Vampire Brady fighting Dorian Gray. Yeah, all right. I'll take it.
I mean, you would think that he knew to make sure to stab her in the heart, because you're right, that's a great sequence. I had trouble with the stuff before that, because it's the cliched, not making sure the hero is dead.
Yes, yeah, and especially with, like, I almost get the feeling that if you're an immortal, you're gonna be like extra suspicious. It's like, yeah, I lopped off their head, but like, I know six guys who are just heads and have been for the last 1,000 years. There's no guarantee of anything.
No,
I was head.
Like it's like the end of that episode of Buffy where they actually bring in Dracula, and the final it was the start of season 5 or 6. But they
didn't watch Buffy, so like I didn't know that they actually like bring in OG.
Oh yeah, no, they
all I remember is. Do you remember Blade Trinity when they bring in OG Dracula, but he's played by Nick Rory from Legends of DC?
But in like the very last moment of this Buffy episode is they think that they've defeated Dracula. Everybody leaves. You wait about 30 seconds. You see him start to reform, and then Buffy stabs him with a stake again. It's like, I've seen the movies. I know how this works.
Yeah, oh, that's like,
and that one scene has more credibility than this entire movie.
This movie doesn't have credibility. I don't know why you went into it believing this would have credibility. This movie was so incredulous. It's why Alan Moore doesn't attach his name to anything. This movie is so bad.
In regard to Mina, I still have issue with the hair.
Yes,
fair.
It's a piece of shit.
Some scenes it looks red, and some scenes it looks brown, and then it's like pretty much straight. And then 5 seconds later, it's these gorgeous ringlet, lush curls and satin. It's like,
it's not even down to her ass.
Okay, anyone that has long hair knows that's not the way hair works. No.
Gorgeous stupidity.
Oh yeah,
wonderfully. Wonderfully inaccurate.
With the final sequence between Mina and Dorian, though, like as wonderful as it was, I do have one question. Why didn't Dorian close his eyes?
Vanity.
Like if you know for a fact that if you stare at this painting, you will die. Yeah.
And that was the whole thing. I mean, it's not as though she just suddenly turned a mirror on him or anything. No. He had no warning. He saw her reaching for, and he's trying to. So yeah, he had time.
Yeah, No, like he had time. He knows what's coming. Instead,
this is a character created by Oscar Wilde, and it is a modern day Narcissus. His tragedy is that he cannot look away.
And you know, if there had been, again, one line, and introduce the idea that that's part of his curse.
Yeah.
Then seeing him actually turn his head to look at the painting would have made sense.
Absolutely. You're expecting way more from Stephen Sommers than the studio, the people who gave him millions of dollars.
Stephen Sommers? Stephen Norrington.
Norrington, that's it. I'm thinking Sommers. Stephen Norrington. Which is even more telling of, like, his career nosedived. And it wasn't a great career to begin with.
Yeah, and I think this movie killed it.
Yes, thankfully.
Wow.
At the same time this came out, the Farrelly brothers, I believe. No, not the Farrelly brothers. The Hughes brothers. They were going really good. They had a great track record of doing like indie crime films, and they made From Hell, starring Johnny Depp, and it killed their careers.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, for a while, it was, if you make an Alan Moore film, your career will end.
Which, yeah, entirely believable. And as I'm looking at Stephen Norrington's IMDb entry, it saddens me greatly to discover that he directed, he was in Return to Oz. And I love that movie.
He was in it?
He was apparently in Return to Oz as Gump.
Hmm. Really?
Yep. Which... Hmm. Oh! Why does he have to be connected to that movie?
Right? How dare. Yeah. We finally get to the last sequence, which is, again, the character arc for Tom Sawyer.
Yeah.
The sudden death of Sean Connery's character, Alan Quartermain, which is still better than Kirk's death. You always got to take that when looking at a crappy character death. How does it compare to Kirk? Still better than Kirk's death.
This movie at least had the balls to more or less keep him dead.
Yes. Yeah. Well, no, you do see his hand go through the ground in the very last frame.
Did we really? Because all I saw was just like the gun shake a little bit.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
It's from a deleted scene.
Okay.
It does, in the original cut that they intended, in the very last frame, the hand comes through, but it's like the last frame, and I guess they cut that back a bit.
Yeah, and speaking of that final shot, looking back on this movie historically, that final shot does not hold up in any way, shape, or form. Because you can't watch it and not immediately go, yeah, we know what was going on with Connery behind the scenes.
Yeah.
We weren't bringing him back.
he didn't want to touch this with a 10-foot pole. They thought about making it, like, centering it around Tom Sawyer. But the kid's career died with this film as well. They thought about making it a Mina Harker one, but the actress didn't want to touch this any more of this.
I don't blame her.
No, me neither. Yeah.
Richard Roxburgh went on from this. His next role, I believe, was Dracula.
Oh, of course it was.
And I adore this era of Richard Roxburgh. Like, it's a trinity of scenery chewing from Moulin Rouge to this,
yeah,
to Dracula, and he plays the quintessential. They're villains from the same era, and they're essentially kind of variations on each other.
Oh, you're gonna love this. According to IMDb, Richard Roxburgh's next credit after The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Van Helsing.
I love being right. I got experience with it.
The early 2000s were not good for that. Oh no.
They were delicious. I will not hear otherwise.
Here's literally what he did in the early between 2003 and 2005. Richard Roxburgh did The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Van Helsing, the Van Helsing video game, and Stealth.
Don't watch Stealth. It's very terrible. But Jamie Foxx is in it.
That's not a good selling point.
The funniest thing is that, like, it was the film he did immediately before Ray. So, like, they kept selling Stealth as, like, starring Academy Award winner Jamie Foxx. It's just, oh my fucking God. It's a film that was made in, I want to say, 2005?
Yeah.
It's about drones, but before anyone knew that drones were an actual thing or, like, common. And so it's like about a drone that goes and these top guns have to shoot it out of the sky.
Stealth, I think the best way to describe it is Stealth is the reason I don't want an Airwolf movie.
Because it's Airwolf.
Stealth is the Airwolf movie we would actually get.
Yeah. I would actually love to see someone take Stealth and redo the graphics so it is Airwolf and like just ADR some Airwolf in there whenever they say the name of the ship. Because yeah, it would be perfect. It would be frightfully perfect.
Now I'm gonna have the theme song from Airwolf in my head for the rest of the day.
She friend says, of mine wrote that on me.
I don't know what the problem is there.
Yeah, no, I do enjoy the theme song.
But with that though, and back to the movie that we're recording for.
James Bond, he nukes Africa, and that sets off a chain of events in which Prospero, who is living in a version of unreality that exists past the mountains of madness in Antarctica, sets off at the same moment the apocalypse. Via a biblical deletion of all story content in the collective humanity because he hates people so much. Like, he never got over being fucking Prospero. And so James Bond has all the other James Bonds lined up. Like, he's got all the others clones. So there's, like, Lazenby, there's Craig, and he uses everyone else as just useless fucking cannon fodder. One of them's old as fuck, and it's Sean Connery.
That's honestly still a better movie.
I love those comics. They're fucking insane. Half of them aren't even in English. He intentionally wrote a bunch of comics in different languages. It's a pain in the ass.
Now, as I was trying to do... let's go into this is gonna be amazing. Let's go into ratings for League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and yeah, Mickey, you're going first.
I give this the Royal Order of the Garter. This doesn't get a film review. this gets royal assent. This film needs to be buried next to like fucking Sir Isaac Newton. In Westminster or wherever the shit. This should be given honors. They should take Margaret Thatcher's body, throw it in the fucking Thames, light the Thames on fire, and then celebrate this instead of Guy Fawkes on November the 5th. That's my review. Fuck you.
God, that was amazing.
Ditto.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, Mickey, first of all, if you cut any of that in editing, save the entire uncut clip, because that's a B-roll right there.
My God, yes.
But while I try to recover, Vito, what about you?
I can't top that. I can't. I'm sitting here going, I don't want to give the movie a 2, but fuck, I don't want to give it a 0 either. No. I like Sean Connery.
Yeah.
That's the holy saving grace. I like Sean Connery. That's it.
Okay, so 1 then?
I wouldn't even give it a full 1. I really know. The only reason that it would have a 1 is because Sean Connery's in it. And that's not reason enough. That's just, no.
Did I forget to mention this occurs in the same universe as 30 Rock? That's canon in both.
What?
It's canon in 30 Rock and League of Extraordinary Gentlemen that they share the same universe.
I need that explained.
Yeah.
So, Who Dat Ninja is a popular film series in the same universe, the future of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen universe. Who Dat Ninja is Tracy Jordan's ninja-based character franchise.
Oh, God, that's amazing.
All right, I don't get that reference. So, yeah.
Watch 30 Rock. It's amazing. Tracy Morgan plays an idiotic version of himself called Tracy Jordan, and he has an Adam Sandler-style career. And Who Dat Ninja is a black ninja. That's okay. The joke. Yeah.
For my part, though, I think I'm giving this a 2, but it's that. Is a very hesitant 2. And a lot of that comes down to the simple fact that the people in front of the camera on this movie, they're trying. God bless them. They are trying so hard.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, this is Roger Corman's Fantastic Four.
Yeah. Basically, and like, this, as a movie, this should work. As a franchise, this should work. And like I said earlier, if this movie were done today, it would totally work. But it's a superhero team-up film in an era where no one had two sweet clues how to make superhero team-up films. And behind the camera, on the other hand, this thing goes wrong in just every way imaginable. And I was also just, as I was listening to you guys give your, I was also thinking to myself, like, this is in the same vein as Robin Hood, the 2018 one, in that this is taking a public domain property and just going batshit insane with it. But the main difference, and by that logic, the reason that I give this a 2 versus Robin Hood's 4 is Robin Hood is extremely honest about the fact that that is exactly what it is. This actually thinks you should take it seriously. And no! No, for the love of God, don't! And, like, in all seriousness, as I mentioned in the Mulan review, like, Mulan is a movie that I normally wouldn't bother watching just because, like, it just doesn't fall in my wheelhouse at all. This is kind of the same thing, because it's like, if we're all in quarantine, we're stuck inside. This will kill about 2 hours, and you will laugh your ass off. If we were not in quarantine, no, I would not tell anyone to watch this movie.
I like historical movies. I like novel reference movies. And I will give this movie at least this much credit. I like the costuming.
Yeah, but other than that, man, did you come to the wrong place.
Not all of them, but I like Nemo's outfits, I like Dorian Gray's outfits, and I like Mina's outfits. The rest of them, they needed a new wardrobe.
And the costuming, thankfully, is drawn directly from the comics. Nemo wore green and black with gold trim and white, not blue.
Oh, see, I like blue.
Yeah, it really does work, and it's a fantastic look. Mina has her long red scarf, which she always has. There's only so much you can do with the Quartermain, but they do it. The Invisible Man, as I said, I love the design when they actually do it, with the facial effects. Mr. Hyde as Biff Tannen. To this day.
This is terrible, but it's actually salvageable, because this is a franchise where, as we see, you can do a movie with a team set in Victorian times.
Yes.
You could still do a sequel with this. Hell, bring Shane West as Tom Sawyer back.
Yeah.
But you could make him almost the Nick Fury / Captain America of a team that's set in the 30s and is pulling from, like, the pulp adventure stories of that era. And you could keep going down the line. Yeah.
That is exactly that to actually pull from. The team later goes on to fight Charlie Chaplin's version of Hitler. There were previous versions that included the Three Musketeers. The fuck on. You can go goddamn crazy with this. It's fantastic. Like, I really, really appreciate Alan Moore's work on this series that he's sustained for 20 years. And 17 of those being after this film killed almost everyone's interest except for, like, the most hardcore fans in the property, which thankfully allowed him to go batshit insane with it, which is how we ended up with Harry Potter the Antichrist.
Oh, I still love that idea anyway. And there's also the simple, like, you have somebody like The Rock, who either is doing or wants to do Doc Savage. So you have your franchise actor right there.
That would be gorgeous. I actually so want to see the Rock as Doc Samson.
Savage.
Doc Savage. I keep wanting to say Doc Bronze, which is the character version of it from Planetary. I really want Planetary to come back.
Well, and I mean, like,
do Planetary movie.
Doc Savage's thing, if I remember right, he's kind of the Hulk with bronze skin, so, like, that's an easy mix-up.
Well, it's a pastiche character.
Yeah.
It's intentionally meant to be. He's a proto Superman character. I love Doc Savage. I used to read the Doc Savage books when I was a kid.
But yeah, and I mean, like I said, there's no reason that this franchise could not work.
Oh, it absolutely these days would work. It would be brilliant. You can pull in so much. People have a much deeper appreciation of it. There's since been a lot of Victorian and Edwardian shows. Penny Dreadful, Peaky Blinders.
Jack.
Yeah, exactly. This can be done so easily now, and people have the awareness of the properties. And being able to make a bunch of internal jokes about making superhero films or stories while doing it with these original versions, it would be fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
I would fall in love with it all over again. I should mention that I've seen this film probably 26 fucking times, and I have on DVD twice. I bought, lost it and then bought it again.
Nice. But now to wrap up, obviously most of us don't really have anything to pitch because it's not like we can go out and do anything, but...
You guys go ahead. Just 1 second.
Okay. So while we're waiting for whatever the heck Mickey's doing, just remember that our next episode will be taking a look at the Canadian indie vampire flick Red Spring, which is actually, I'm really looking forward to that review. We're actually going to have what is easily the biggest guest this show has ever had and probably ever will have. So stay tuned for that. And now that Mickey's back, was I stalling for a specific thing?
So here's Harry Potter breathing fire.
What?
Onto Nina and Lando. This is the head of Aleister Crowley. He's ruining this. Here he is. Christ. I've completely... Here's Mary Poppins. She's about to use God powers against him. God power Mary Poppins, which liquefies him. You'll notice he's the biblical Antichrist. He has multiple. And there's a moment earlier when he slaughters everyone in Hogwarts, and they murder everyone. Here's Britannia in the spirit of the new millennium as a sex doll. here's the doctor.
What? You froze.
Here's the doctor.
Oh my god!
The 11th, no less, from the looks of it.
Indeed. The rest... Oh, no, he's with one. See its heart now?
Oh, there's one,
The end of the screen. The end of the frame.
Okay, yeah, one, so and it's definitely
it's
11.
One and 11. Oh, yeah, here's Al killing himself. Anyway. Oh, and there's a painting on the back of the Shoggoth that Harry Potter eventually would become, that would rule over our universe.
Oh, obvious rights issues notwithstanding, I want this movie.
I'm amazed he doesn't care. He doesn't call the character Harry Potter at all. It's just heavily referenced.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Oh, and Voldemort rapes Mina at a Rolling Stones concert. That actually happened. Like the Rolling Stones concert that they're referring to actually happened.
Oh, of course.
So it's like, yeah, no.
All right, but until next time, and just the simple fact that I should probably hit stop now. Hit those like and subscribe buttons, share this video with your friends, and drop us a line anytime you like.